So I am one of David Corey's PhD students. And today, what he wants me to talk about is the control of quantum systems. So this is sort of a pretty broad topic, and there's sort of a more theoretical side where people talk about the theory of quantum control, what's possible, what's not possible, that sort of thing. And then there are also more practical aspects to quantum control, like if you have a system in the lab, what's the best thing to do given your noise sources, et cetera. So we're going to be focusing mostly on this second piece, practical aspects of quantum control. But first we need to review, well, what does it mean to control a quantum system? What does it mean to have control of a quantum system? So this is the standard paradigm. Is this writing clear? Is it big enough?
It's definitely big enough.
Okay. Okay, good. So what we have is a Hamiltonian called H-naught, which we call the drift Hamiltonian. This is a piece of our Hamiltonian that we cannot turn off, right? It's the piece that's always on in the background. It's just inherent. Maybe it's due to some large external magnetic field. Maybe it's due to couplings between spins in a sample. Who knows what it is, but it's always there. And then in addition to this, you also have a whole bunch of so-called control Hamiltonians, H1 through HL. And we call them control Hamiltonians because the total Hamiltonian of our quantum system looks like this. So it's the piece we can't turn off, plus a bunch of coefficients. Of our control Hamiltonians, and what we can do to our Hamiltonian is we can deterministically manipulate these functions in time. So that's what we're allowed to do. That's our resource. So as an example, so this is the simplest possible example. It's also an example that happens all the time because every lab in the world has single qubits somewhere, right? So you have an internal Hamiltonian, which is by convention usually along the z-axis. Right, so a sigma z. And then you have control Hamiltonians which are along the x and y axes, and this is so-called quadrature control. So something like that. Right, so here we're probably in some kind of rotating reference frame. This delta term is probably the difference between our driving frequency and our static field frequency, but those are just details, right? This is sort of a very standard setup to have for a single qubit. And you can imagine adding more qubits, you'd have more terms like these with coupling terms and stuff like that. Maybe you can control the x and y of each of your qubits. And we might have additional considerations, right? So this alpha is sort of the resources we're allowed to control these as a function of time. Maybe there are restrictions on that. Well, how are we applying these alphas? Well, we're probably applying some classical field to our quantum system to add coefficients to those Hamiltonians. And right, so maybe we're controlling them by adding some external magnetic field to create a coefficient for H1. And we can only make fields so big. So maybe we have a power limit, which says that that the norm of our coefficients is bounded above by some number a for every time. And maybe maybe we don't have instantaneous control. So maybe we can't change the value of alpha instantaneously from one point to the next. So maybe we force alpha to be differentiable, and we have to bound its derivative. So it's sort of Lipschitz. So okay. So this is the setup. This is what we have. Now let's talk about what we want. So we're going to talk today about unitary control. There are different types of control. The reason we're talking about unitary control is because it's the most relevant to quantum information processing. There are other types of control, like pure state control and stuff like that. So this is our problem. Okay, so if we're given some coefficients alpha on some time interval from 0 to t, we know what's going to happen during that interval because we know Schrodinger's equation, right? Right, so we know that at time capital T, this is going to be the unitary invoked by this particular value of alpha. Does that make sense? Right, and so this is the time-ordered solution to Schrodinger's equation given our Hamiltonian, which is a function of time, which is a function of our control amplitudes, which we can also call our pulse. So our problem is sort of an inverse problem, right? So this statement up here is a statement about simulation. Given an alpha, we can find this u. We're sort of interested in the inverse problem. If we want to perform this unitary, how do we pick the alpha to make this true? Right? And we don't care what phi is, that's just a global phase. Um, Right? So in some cases, it's sort of easy to pick alpha to make this statement true for some given you desired. So I can give you sort of a trivial example. So let's say that our drift Hamiltonian is 0. Our H1 is along the x direction. Our H2 is along the y direction. And u desired is just the Pauli x vector. So it's a bit flip. So we take 0 to 1 and 1 to 0. Right. So how are we going to pick alpha to make this u desired at time t? Right. Either of you see the solution? Anyone? Right. So what we're allowed to do is we're allowed to rotate about the x direction, or we're allowed to rotate about the y direction continuously, or we're allowed to rotate about some linear combination of these two directions. It's really nice and easy because our drift Hamiltonian isn't taking us some direction we don't care to go. So all we have to do is we have to travel along only this direction for the right amount of time. Right? So so set alpha of t to be a constant function where the x is pi over t and the y is 0, right? Then if we look at u of alpha, it's going to be H naught, which is 0, plus alpha 1, which is pi over t, times H1, which is 1 half of sigma x. And alpha 2 is 0. And we can all do this exponential, right? It's just the exponential of negative I pi over 2 sigma x, which is, if we pull out Euler's equation, it's the sine of pi over 2 times identity minus I cos pi over 2 sigma x is equal to negative I sigma x. All right, so here's u desired as we wanted. And here's some global phase that we don't care about. So this was, when your internal Hamiltonian is 0, it makes life pretty easy. You just go in the direction that you need to go in. So one natural question you might have with this setup is, suppose someone tells you these Hamiltonians, H0 through HL, is it even possible to do anything, right? If you pick some you desired sort of at random, is it possible to find an alpha which gets you, which takes you in this finite time interval from identity to you desired? So I have a page here which sort of outlines exactly when that's possible, right? So there's a very concise statement about when H0 through HL are sufficient to have this sort of universal control. But I'm going to save this for the end if I have time. In practice, basically every quantum system has universal control unless you have a lot of symmetry in your system, right? If, like for example, if you have a 1D spin chain where all of your Hamiltonians are the same, you probably have a lot of symmetry and you're probably not going to get universal control. But if all of your Hamiltonians are different and you're allowed to like change enough of them as functions of time, then you probably do have universal control. And if you pick your Hamiltonian sort of at random, this is a result from like 2005 or something by Seth Lloyd. If you just pick your Hamiltonians at random, you will have universal control, right? So you sort of have to be in a low-dimensional subspace of Hamiltonians in order to not have full control. But anyways, what we're going to do is we're going to move ahead to something called numerical optimal control. Unless there are any questions right now. Okay. So this example over here was quite trivial, right? The target of interest happened to be on the path of one of our control Hamiltonians. So all we needed to do was turn on this control Hamiltonian and wait. It might not be so obvious how to pick alpha in more general settings. If your drift Hamiltonian is crazy and it's taking you in some direction that you don't really want to go, you sort of have to counteract that while trying to get to you desired as well. And so for any non-trivial Hamiltonian, it's a lot of work to find good pulses. And so often you need to either engineer your quantum system to have nice Hamiltonians, which are easy to find solutions to, or you need to resort to numerical optimal control, right? Or you need to be really smart and come up with something clever that's specific to your system. But numerical optimal control is sort of a catch-all. So okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to discretize our problem. So here we were treating alpha as sort of a continuous parameter of time. So we're going to discretize our time domain. Into m steps. Of length dt, or sorry, delta t. So m times delta t is equal to capital T. And then we're going to discretize our pulse alpha, and we're going to call it q. So we are going to say that QML is the amplitude of the Lth control at time step M. So the picture that you should have is if we plot alpha L as a function of time, maybe it looks like that. And then we discretize the time domain into M pieces. And then Q are all of these finite amplitudes. So Q is just a matrix of dimension capital M, capital L. So it looks like that. And then we get the approximation. U alpha is approximately approximately equal to this time slicing, right? So we just have a sequence of unitaries happen. And in each of these sequences, our Hamiltonian is constant. So we can just integrate over each of these and then multiply over our time slices in the right order, and we will get the effect of the total pulse. So we need to remember, since this pulse happens first, it needs to be on the right. Right, because if we put our pure state over on the right, then U1 acts in our pure state, then U2 acts on the result, then U3 acts on the result, and so on. And I'm calling this thing UM. Okay. So that's step one of numerical optimal control, is to discretize time domain. Step two, yeah.
Is there somewhere in there that tells me at which time I should turn that time domain on for each piece?
That's sort of done implicitly by this multiplication. It doesn't really matter where it starts. It just matters what the strength is and what the duration is. And if you multiply them in the right order, right? So this corresponds to a unitary, this corresponds to a unitary. You just multiply them up. So it's only the duration that matters.
Step two is to write down, we're going to do a numerical maximization, so we need to write down a utility function.
You looks like you have another question. Okay.
So our utility function is going to tell us how good a particular choice of Q is at getting towards our desired unitary. And you can think of different ways of choosing this function. I'm going to write down the standard way of choosing this function. You could, for example, look at the norm between UQ and U desired, right? This isn't what I'm going to do, but you could look at UQ take away U desired. There's nothing really wrong with this, right? So this would be the trace norm. There's nothing really wrong with this, but the problem is it doesn't allow you to have a global phase. You're saying this has to literally be equal to this for this value of Q to be good, but we want to allow for a global phase to be in there because it's pretty annoying to get the global phase right and to get U desired right. So we're going to use this formula. So we're going to take the inner product between u desired and u of q. And we're going to normalize by the dimension of the Hilbert space squared, just so that this thing lies in the interval 0 to 1. Okay, so this function tells us whether or not a given q causes our simulation to be close to the desired result. And now what we're going to do is sort of the most naive algorithm possible, right? We're going to do gradient ascent. So if we imagine phi as a function, right, it has a lot of inputs, right? It has m times l inputs, so I can only draw three dimensions at best. So I'm just going to say, well, this is one, maybe this is q11, this is q12, and then there are a whole bunch of other dimensions which I can't draw. And then on the z-axis is our utility function phi. We know it has a range between 0 and 1, and this defines a control landscape, right? So it has peaks and valleys. And where we want to be is at the top of one of these peaks, because the point down there corresponds to the desired unitary after we simulate it. So our algorithm is going to be pick a random spot, any spot. Maybe you have a heuristic. Maybe you have a good guess of a good spot to start. But in general, you just pick a random spot anywhere in your control landscape, and you start going uphill. And this is called the grape algorithm. So this stands for, the GR stands for gradient, ascent, pulse engineering. So, so we'll start with some q naught, and then we'll start taking steps. We're going to set qk plus 1 to be equal to our new pulse is going to be equal to our old pulse, plus some direction which is uphill. So what does uphill mean? It means the gradient of our objective function at the point qk. And then we need some step size, right? Because we don't want to take a step which is too far. We'll go way past the hill, and we don't want to take a step too short, because it'll take forever to get up the hill. Okay. So if we want this, algorithm to work, we need to know how to find derivatives of our utility function. And one problem with this whole scheme, this is general to all numerical optimal control, is that it's highly non-scalable. It involves being able to simulate your quantum system. So you can probably do this for like 10 qubits at best before it. I mean, even that would be a huge pain. So And so if computing phi alone is annoying, imagine having to compute the gradient of phi, right? The naive thing to do is to change each of your amplitudes in turn and see if that makes phi better or worse, right? So sort of do a finite difference type derivative on this function, see which of the control amplitudes make phi better, which ones make it worse. That'll inform you of which direction is uphill. So it turns out that there's a better way to do this. It magically turns out that computing the gradient of phi has the same computational cost as computing phi itself. So I'll show you how that works. So the gradient of phi is an array. We need to take all possible derivatives with respect to the control amplitudes. So we need to take derivatives of this form. Right, so this is the trick. So I'm going to abbreviate U desired to UD. So we have this formula, and then we'll expand it out. So we have this expansion. I'm going to define this thing to be XM, actually PM dagger. I'm going to define this thing to be XM. So then I can rewrite this as 1 over d squared of the trace of PM dagger XM. Now I need to take the absolute value squared, so I'll multiply by the complex conjugate of this quantity. Which is equal to that. And now I want to start taking derivatives of this thing. So the first thing to note is that by definition, PM does not depend on QML, right? Because it starts at M plus 1. So if I take the derivative with respect to QML, only this term is going to be affected. So die PM by die QML is equal to 0. And if I take the derivative of XM with respect to QML, it is the derivative of UM with respect to QML times UM minus 1 to U1. And now if I look at the definition of UM, QML just appears as a coefficient to HL. So I get negative I dt HL U M X M, right? So the derivative of X with respect to QML is pretty straightforward. You just pull the HL out front. I've made a mistake. Pardon?
Is that the back one?
Yeah. Where to write next? I guess I'll go back over there. So now, phi by QML is, I just need to use the product rule. So take the derivative of that, then the derivative of that. Over d squared. So this term is the complex conjugate of that term. So this whole derivative just simplifies to the real part of this multiplication. Now, if you're thinking about the simulation of your system to compute phi, the most expensive part is doing those matrix exponentials, right? So that's really expensive to do m matrix exponentials. Relatively, multiplying them all together is pretty cheap, right? That sort of goes as order d squared, whereas the matrix exponential goes as sort of order d cubed plus a higher constant overhead. And so we see that computing this derivative, all it uses is multiplications of the um, right? And we only need to compute all of the matrix exponentials once. And then by multiplying them in different ways, we can compute phi. Or in multiplying them in this way, right? Because these are just products of the UM, we can compute the derivatives. So this is why computing gradients is basically the same computational cost modulo a different number of matrix multiplications to computing phi itself. Okay. So at this moment, I want to I just want to show you what this looks like in in practice. So if you wouldn't mind, would you mind coming closer so we can look at the screen? So this will just be a couple of minutes. So so here I have an actual implementation of this grape algorithm. So I'll show you what it really looks like. So the first thing we do is we define our Hamiltonians. So H0. Z, H1 is X, H2 is Y. And then I define U desired. In this case, it's the same as that example. So X is, the U desired is sigma X. And then I defined power limits. So I'm saying that the amplitude of H1 has to be between these two numbers, and the amplitude of H2 has to be between these two numbers. And then I'm saying my time step is 0.05 units of time. I have 20 time steps. And now I'm going to pick a random pulse. So Q naught is my random pulse. This is what it looks like. So this is the amplitude of H1 as a function of time, the amplitude of H2 as a function of time. And if I just simulate this, starting at the top of the Bloch sphere, this is what that pulse does. So it just takes me somewhere random, some random squiggle. So now I'm going to take this initial guess and run it through the grape algorithm. So here it took 10 steps. So here we see the utility function. So it starts at 56%. And then I've told it to stop when it gets to 4/9. So it stops at 0.999976. And it ends up looking like that, right? So it really doesn't, just looking at it, comparing it to the initial guess, there's no way you would guess that this is a better pulse. But it takes you from 0 to 1 if you simulate it under that pulse. Now,
would that, for like some other input state, would it still act like a rotation?
Yeah, right. So the problem with plotting these things is that there's so many dimensions. So the reason I'm plotting it on the Bloch sphere with one initial state is simply because it makes a nice picture, mm-hmm. right? But yeah, if you started with that state, x, right, that's an eigenstate of your operation. So it could take some loop, but it should end up back where it started.
Cool.
I can show you that in a bit. I also want to show you this. So in the real world, we don't know the coefficients of our Hamiltonian perfectly, right? So this is what happens if you modify the coefficient of H naught. Right, so up there, the coefficient of H naught was equal to 0.1 times 2 pi. Down here, I'm saying, well, let's sweep it between 0 and 0.2. Right? So at 0.1, it goes from 0 to 1. But at these other points, it goes somewhere else. So this is saying that our pulse is not robust. Right? It's not robust to variations in coefficients of the Hamiltonian. So that's what I'm going to talk about now. Is how do we add robustness to plots and or to pulses? So just as an example, here I'm plotting the utility function as a function of the coefficient of H naught, right? So we see right at 0.1, it's really high, mm-hmm. but it goes down to like less than 90%, which is useless for quantum information, mm-hmm. Depending on what you're doing. For quantum computers, it's definitely useless.
Cool.
Okay, so so now we're going to modify our paradigm slightly. So we're going to say now that our Hamiltonians depend on some vector of parameters. In that example that I just showed you, this vector would have length 1, and it would be delta omega, so the coefficient of z. So in this case, x would be delta omega, and h naught would be delta omega times sigma z over 2. H1 don't depend on x at all. That's fine. Okay. So we would call this an offset error, because our resonance frequency is offset from the frequency we're applying. But anyways, we can also have over-rotation errors. So maybe maybe there's some coefficient here that you don't know about. So when you try to rotate by pi, you actually rotate by pi plus pi over 10. Right. So it's an example. And so let's plot phi as a function of x. Right, so it's some nominal value that you care about. Maybe you've made a good solution there. But if you deviate from that place even slightly, the fidelity or the utility function goes way down. So this is a not robust pulse. What we would prefer is something like this. We would prefer the utility function to be broad for a wide range of x. So this is the region of robustness. So maybe I don't understand, but so there are two different pulses,
yeah.
Two different solutions. The one on the left is only good for a particular value of x. The one on the right is good for a whole wide range of x. I'm not sure if that answered.
Yeah, I just need to see where the two pulses
are. Are you asking whether those are pulses?
Yeah, asking, for example, he picks this model, the one on the Philly Hamiltonian, the drifting Hamiltonian, and the control Hamiltonian. So from there, using what we did, you can calculate the utility function. Mm-hmm. So I was just trying to say that the one on the left, for example, what you get, and the one on the right is what you want to get.
Yeah. You should think about it that way. So, with the scheme that we did over there, you'll end up with something like the one on the left. Mm-hmm. With the scheme I'm about to show you, you'll end up with something more like on the right.
Okay, thanks.
So I mean, just like our previous scheme, this scheme is also throw more numerics at the problem. So what we're going to do is say, all right, every time I try to do an experiment, I'm going to get some particular value of x. And every time I repeat that experiment, I might get a different value of x. And these x's are chosen according to this probability distribution. And what I want is that every time I perform an experiment, even though the x's are different, if they really are chosen from this probability distribution, then I will get u desired. So basically what I want is I want that flatness region to subsume the probability distribution. So I want the utility to be good over the support of my probability distribution over here. That way, no matter which value I pick from here, I will have high utility. Okay, so now I'm going to write down a conditional utility function. So now my utility function depends not only on q, but also on x. And it's something you probably would guess. So it's just the desired unitary times the simulation with the pulse q and the Hamiltonians with this particular value of x. So like that. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to set my new utility function, which is a function of only q, to be the average value of my conditional utility function. So I'm saying that if I average my conditional utility over this distribution, I still want to end up with a good solution.
You don't weight that average.
Well, it's weighted by the distribution. Right, so if you think that most of the time my x's lie over here, but sometimes they're over there, then the pulse should find a solution that is best in the dense region of support, and a pulse that's OK in the region of low support. Right, but we need to do numerics, and doing this integral sounds awful. So we're going to approximate our probability distribution as a particle distribution. So it's a weight of delta functions centered at xi for some finite number of I. And this is a terrible approximation point-wise. But in expectation, it is a great approximation. Right? So if our distribution looks like this, then our particles will be a whole bunch of them over there and some over there. And then 5q is just going to be the weighted average of our conditional distributions, because we're integrating over a convex combination of these conditional guys, right? So basically what I'm asking is I want the pulse to be good here, 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 weighted by these WIs. And if it's good here and here, these points are sort of close together that I expect it to be good in between as well. And then we do the same algorithm. So this is our utility function. We go uphill. It's a convex combination of functions we already know how to take the derivative of. The derivative operator is linear. So if we want to take the gradient of this thing, then we just have to take the weighted average of the derivatives. Like that. Okay. So that's basically it. I have another plot of what happens when you do this as opposed to what we just did. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so again, we start with the Hamiltonians, but this time we're not putting a number here. We're leaving it as a symbol. And we have the same desired unitary. We have power limits again. We have time steps, initial guess. This is what our initial guess does. It takes us from here to here. And then here's my distribution. So I'm saying that my distribution is a uniform distribution from 0 to 0.2. And then I end up with these 20 particles, which I picked at random.
Yeah, and what are the
0.2?
Arbitrary.
I mean, it depends on your physical system. So you need to say, well, I think that my parameter is actually going to be any of these numbers. So that's how you set your distribution. But this example is contrived, so it's just arbitrary. And then it ended up with this pulse. And if I pick one value of x, this is what it does. But what I'm really interested in doing is picking a whole bunch of values. So this is a comparison of our previous pulse with this pulse. So so here's our region that we cared about, so 0 to 0.2. And we see that it's just way flatter. Right, so our utility function is flatter over a larger region.
All of us.
Yeah, and then we can also do this plot. So they're basically they're much closer together.
Okay.
Yeah. Cool. So that was sort of a whirlwind introduction.
Yeah, that's great. I need that one.